nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
All right, then welcome to Lecture 2. Now, first of all, I want to preface this here to say this is probably the dullest lecture you're going to hear all semester. Now, maybe not, you know, but I think so. You know, we're going to be talking about some math. Some of you have done this before in its old hat. You know, please don't fall asleep. You know, when you're up in front lecturing and you see people dozing off, it kind of, you know, saps your energy level. But some of you haven't had much practice with it. You know, and it's not that difficult. You should spend some time to make sure you know how to do this math, because then the math won't get in the way for the rest of the course. You know, otherwise, it'll always, you know, get in the way and confuse you, and you won't be able to focus on the physics. So I'm going to go through some of the basic sums and integrals that we'll need to do throughout the class. And you should get some practice with that. Okay, so this is what we're going to talk about. You know, things like density of states in K-space. We'll work out an example. You may be more used to working out these problems in the energy space, so we'll talk about that and then discuss one or two things. So mostly I think I'm reminding you of things that you've by and large seen before. So we'll think about having a big chunk of semiconductor with some volume omega. And, you know, this is, you know, what we're thinking of, this is very large. It has some dimensions Lx times Ly times Lz. And there's a bunch of atoms in there. So there are n sub a atoms per cubic centimeter. So if I take n sub a times the volume omega, that's the total number of atoms. So if you think about how these energy bands come about, you know, you have these energy levels for each atom, and when you put the atoms together and the wave functions overlap, they broaden into bands, and that's where the bands come. You know, there's each atom contributes a level or a series of levels. So when you make the bands, the number of states, there's one for each atom in the volume. Right? So there's a finite number of states in there. So the total number of states, electronic states in this volume is, you know, the total number of states in the conduction band is just the number of atoms in the volume, times two, because they're spin. It can be spin up or spin down. And the same number of states in the valence band, and if there are upper bands that can come in, each one has some states. Okay, now, funny things might happen at these surfaces. There may be dangling bonds, you know. There's a change in the periodic potential. We have block functions inside, but we lose the periodicity at the boundary. So funny things might happen at the boundaries. But we're going to assume that we're talking about a bulk semiconductor. The boundaries are far away. You know, we're talking about a big volume, but it's inside the bulk of the device, far from the boundaries. So the boundaries have no effects. We need some microscopic treatment of what's happening at the boundaries if we want to treat surface states and Fermi-level pinning and all the complicated things that can go on there. But we're not going to worry about that. So this is some volume inside a much bigger volume. And all we need to do is to figure out how to set the boundary conditions in a way that we get the proper number of states. And we'll do it in the simplest possible way. You know, there are a couple of ways that people do it. You can have box boundary conditions. We could assume that the wave function is zero at the both ends and get sine functions. Or you could do periodic boundary conditions. And it all, in the end, it all works out the same because they're the same number of states. So the simplest way to do it, I think, is to assume periodic boundary conditions. Right. So we know the solutions here are block functions, and since the boundary conditions are periodic, there are block functions everywhere. And in order to make the solutions periodic, the wave function at x equals 0 has to equal the wave function at the end, x equals Lx. And same thing in the y direction and the z direction. All right. So The periodic part is no problem because, you know, it keeps repeating itself at every atom. So we don't have to worry about that. That's going to be the same at the two ends. But in order to make the wave part the same, we have to make e to the I kx lx equal to 1, right? Because at x equals 0, this thing is 1, right? Okay, so what we want to do then is to work out some observables, you know, like ask questions like, how many electrons are there in this volume? That's capital N. You know, it's some number, 5 times 10 to the 22nd or whatever. Well, all we would do is a sum. There's some discrete number of states. So we go over the whole Brillouin zone. For each K state, we look at what energy it is. This comes from the dispersion, from the EK relation. In the simplest case, it's E is equal to H bar squared K squared over 2M, but it might be just something we know numerically, you know, from a band structure calculation. For each K, we find the energy. We put it in the Fermi function, which gives us the probability between 0 and 1 that that state is occupied. We go through all of the states, and we just sum them all up. And that'll give us the total number of electrons. If this is a big volume, that's going to be a difficult sum to do, so we have to talk about how to do that. Now, usually you're more interested in things like, we just took some arbitrary chunk out of this big semiconductor with volume omega. Right? If we had taken a volume twice as big, we would have had twice as many electrons. So it's usually more sensible to talk about things like the electron density per cubic centimeter. Just divide by the volume that we've taken to do our bookkeeping. So we get the electron density per cubic centimeter. So this is what we want to know how to compute. How do we compute the electron density per square centimeter? And there are a lot of K states. You know, there are a lot of atoms in this big volume. And there's going to be a lot of discrete K states for each one of those atoms. And if we try to sum them, sometimes it makes sense. If we're talking about quantum wells or quantum wires, where the allowed states are spaced very widely, then you just add up the results. But if you're talking about a bulk material where it's big, there are a lot of states. You can't add them. So we're going to integrate. They're spaced so finely, we'll do an integral. But we need to make sure that in some volume of K space, we get the proper number of states. So N sub K is going to be the density of states in K space. So N sub K times D cubed K is the total number of states in that volume of K space. Just, you know, if we were able to count them all up, that's what we would get. So we need to figure out what that density of states in K space is. All right, so let's just do it in one direction, one dimension to begin with. So here's along the x direction. You know, the wave function will be a block function. We want the wave function to be the same at x equals 0 and at x equals lx. That means e to the I k lx has to equal 1. That means the argument kx lx has to be an integer number of 2 pi's. Right? And any one of those will satisfy it. Okay. So if I solve for kx, it's just 2 pi over the length of this volume in the x direction times an integer. And I just get a discrete number of k states. And if you look at the number that are there, and if these atoms are spaced by lattice spacing A, you know, in the end of my Brillouin zone would be pi over A, you'll get one state for every atom. So each one of these is an allowed k state. And you can see if Lx is very big, they're really finely spaced. That's why we're going to integrate and not sum. So we have these finely spaced K states. All right. From the center of the Brillouin zone to the end. There are some, now I ask the question, I have some region in K space, some DK. How many states are there in that region? Well, each one of these states takes up 2 pi over Lx. That's how they're spaced. Each one of them takes up a length in K space of 2 pi over Lx. So if I want to know how many states are there in this little region DK, The number of states is the length of that region in K-space divided by how much space each state takes up in K-space, 2 pi over Lx, times 2 for spin. This is the density of states times dk in K-space. So n of k dk is the total number of states in K-space, and we figured it out. Let's see, n of k then is just going to be Lx over 2 pi times 2, so it's Lx over pi. Right. Depends on the size. So in 3D, it would work the same way in the other three directions. You know, and this is like, so the number of states in 1D was Lx over 2 pi. If I do it in the y direction, I get the same answer, Ly over 2 pi. In the z direction, I get Lz over 2 pi. At the end of it all, I multiply by 2 for spin. Lx times Ly times Lz is the volume that I'm working with here. So it's volume over 8 pi squared times 2 for spin. So the final density of states in K-space is omega over 4 pi cubed. Okay. All right. So what that means is that instead of doing this sum and just going through and adding them up one at a time, I'll do an integral. But I'll integrate d cubed k times this density of states in k-space. The density of states is constant, so I can pull it out. So this is my prescription for converting sums to integrals. I guess most of you have seen that before. Right. So that's how, so that's how we do that. Questions before we, yes?
So the density of states are regardless of the material, the number of atoms, any parameter is always constant in K-space?
Yeah, so that's a very important point. In K-space, things are simple, right? The density of states is uniform, it's constant, it's not material dependent.
It only depends on the volume.
Yep. It depends on that arbitrary volume, you know, and that's why, which makes sense, you know, the bigger the volume is, the more states, you know. So the bigger the volume is, the more states I have in that volume. But usually when I get all done, I'm interested in things like number of atoms per unit volume. So you divide by that volume and it all comes out. So the volume is just, this is just an artifact that we use in the problem to help us count the states. In the final answers, the results will come out to be independent of the volume. Yeah?
What about the negative k-states? We never consider negative k-states, but in periodic, if you assume periodic boundary conditions, they would be separate solutions.
Let me think about that. When we're summing over those k-states, we're going from 0 to k. Let me come back. And you're right. Yeah, we've done. I'm not having a very good answer. The negative k states are there too, right?
You need a factor of 2.
No, we don't need a factor of 2. But what if I. Let me think about that. It has to be a better answer. But, I mean, this is the right answer and includes both the plus and the, you know, all of the k-states. But anybody have the answer to that?
When you integrate it, then you can include negative.
Pardon me?
When you integrate this Boolean zone, that time you can include the negative.
Yeah, when we integrate, we're going to integrate these over the negative k-states. Yeah, you're right. Okay, yeah, it's very simple. I'm confusing myself. Yeah. I mean, this is the density of states. So these are the number of states in this volume d cubed k. When we integrate, we have to integrate over the plus k states and the minus k states. And in fact, that's frequently, sometimes you forget to integrate over the negative k states and you're off by a factor of 2. So we figured out how finely spaced they are. They're just as finely spaced over here. And when we do the sum, we'll sum over plus k and minus k. Yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah.
In slide 3, you mentioned if there are n atoms, then there will be 2n number of states.
Mm-hmm.
Is it in general to say, like, I consider a chain of n atoms? So, it depends on this potential profile, right? I mean, how we solve it.
Well, so I think the way I think of it, you know, where did these states come from? They came from the individual atoms had a discrete number of energy levels. Each atom has, you know, five levels or however many we're taking. When you put them together, they all interact. You don't lose any of those states. They spread out, they smear out. You know, this every atom in that solid has to contribute that many. Those states, you know, there's... They can't disappear or be added. They all came from the individual atomic levels from each of the atoms. So they're there. Yeah. Yeah.
So if we assume a box boundary condition in this, then the density of the states will be spaced by LX over, pi over LX, right?
Yeah.
And then the number of states or the density of states will be different.
Yeah, and then when you do the sums, you have to be a little bit careful about how you do it. And yeah. And, you know, in the end, you end up getting the same result, but you have to sum over the k-states in a little bit different way. Yeah. Yeah. If you do your bookkeeping carefully, the box boundary conditions or the periodic boundary conditions will all come out the same. Maybe we'll work that out in one of these discussion sessions and show how that works out. Okay, well, what about 2D? So a lot of our problems now are going to be things like silicon inversion layers or thin films of material, where we're going to assume that the electrons are squeezed down in one direction and they can only move in the other two directions. So we'll call them two-dimensional electrons. We want to do the same kind of sums. So we want to do things like sum over the k states, but we want to ask questions like, how many electrons are there in that area A? So instead of having a volume, we have an area A in a plane. So we want to ask, how many electrons are there in that area? But usually it'll make more sense. If this is a big sheet, the boundary conditions, the boundaries aren't anywhere near, we're ignoring their effect. We're usually more interested in the number of electrons per square centimeter, right? Because if I have twice the area, I'll have twice as many electrons. So I want to divide out the area. So this is the sum that we have to do. But the sum now is over the k states in the xy plane. So it's the same as before. I have an lx over 2 pi times an ly over 2 pi. Lx times Ly is area. 2 pi times 2 pi is 2 pi squared. Multiply by 2 for spin, so I get A over 2 pi squared. So the density of states is different in 2D. But now, when I do the sum, I have to be a little bit careful. Because Kz was quantized. It was squeezed down. So the states here are spaced 2 pi over LZ, which is this thin thickness T. They're spaced very, very widely, not finely. Right. So I do have to sum over KZ as well. But since these things are spaced so widely, it oftentimes only one of them matters. The Fermi level is above one of them. The other ones are very high, so I don't even have to worry about them. But at the end, I need to do one more sum. This one I won't try to integrate. If only one subband is occupied, then I just do this integral. My 2D density of states is dkx, dky, divided by 1 over 2 pi squared. But if there's a second subband that's occupied, it'll have higher energies, and I just add them all up. So there may be 1, 2, 3, 4 subbands. But here, I don't have to worry about integrating. I just add them.
So yes. This one should be from minus infinity, the integral.
You're right. So help me get the typos out of these things too. Yeah, it should be minus infinity. Yeah, we're integrating. It actually should be over a Brillouin zone, but the Fermi function will make sure I usually don't have to go to the end of the Brillouin zone. Yeah. Plus k, plus pi over a to minus pi over a or whatever. Okay, so we have to worry about that sum over subband. All right, and now you can see what's going to happen in 1D. So in 1D, I still want the total number of electrons in this arbitrary length of the wire, just the number, right? But it's going to make more sense to ask what's the number per unit length, because it's uniform, the ends are a long ways away. If I'd made L twice as long, I'd get twice as many electrons, so it makes more sense to compute the number per unit length. So I have to do this sum. So L is going to be a large bookkeeping length that I work on, and I just convert this sum to an integral. The number of states now is just L over 2 pi times 2 for spin, so the density of states is L over pi. When I do the integral, again, I've got the typo here, we just integrate from minus pi over a to plus pi over a, of course, across the Brillouin zone, and then we insert the density of states here. I have the same problem. I have subbands. So if there are additional subbands that are occupied due to the quantum confinement in the other two directions, the ky and the kz direction, they're spaced very widely. I just add up the results. Okay. Okay, so as I said, many of you have seen this before. I just wanted to go through it because this is what we're going to assume that you know and we're going to be using frequently. So in 1D, the density of states in K-space is L over pi. In 2D, it's area over 2 pi squared. In 3D, it's volume over 4 pi cubed. Independent of band structure, it's the same all the time. And, you know, the volume element is different in 1D, 2D, or 3D. Okay. Okay, so here's where the lecture gets really dull. We'll work out an example. All right. And you ought to be able to do these kinds of calculations. So we'll go through one, and I've assigned some things for you to do for practice. So let's compute the electron density in 3D. What we really want is not the number, but the number per unit volume. 1 over omega times the sum over all the k states, and then we weight each state by the probability that it's occupied. That's an equilibrium Fermi function. That's what the F sub 0 means. 0 means equilibrium. And we know what the Fermi function is. It's 1 over 1 plus E minus EF over KT. Now, so here's where band structure is going to come in. Because for a particular K state, I have to know what energy that corresponds to in order to find the probability that it's occupied. The only way I know that is I know the EK relation. Right. That's material dependent. Okay, so we convert the sum to an integral. We use the density of states. And now the omegas divide out. We were only using it for bookkeeping, so we didn't want it to be in the final answer anyway. And we get n is 1 over 4 pi cubed, integral from 0 to infinity, F naught E of K D cubed K. All right, and we just have to work out that integral, that's all. We're going to see lots of these kind of integrals. Okay, so how do we do it? So we could use our volume element. The surface area of a square is 4 pi radius squared. So K is just the radius of the wave vector in KX, KY, KZ coordinate system. Surface area times dk, that's my volume element. Here's my Fermi function in the numerator, in the denominator, I'm sorry. Now I have to assume a specific E of k in order to do this, to get any further. I'll assume parabolic bands. So the total energy of the electron is whatever it is at the bottom of the conduction band plus h bar squared k squared over 2m. Okay. All right, so we just put that in. Let's see, 4 pi's cancel here. And downstairs I have 1 plus E to the EC plus H bar squared K squared over 2M minus the Fermi level and all divided by KT. And that's the integral that I have to work out. Okay, I'm going to define a parameter that I'm going to use a lot. So you should sort of remember it. Eta F. So eta F is the location of the Fermi level with respect to the bottom of the band in units of KT. So it's positive if the Fermi level is above the bottom of the band, but it can be negative for a non-degenerate semiconductor. It's just below the bottom of the band. So I'm just going to define that parameter in order to get rid of this term divided by the KT. So now my expression becomes 1 over pi squared k squared dk divided by 1 plus e to the minus a to f, the way it's been defined, times e to the h bar squared k squared over 2 mkt. Again, just an integral to work out. It's going to turn out we can't do this integral, right? So we're just going to give it a name. Right. All right, so here's the integral that we have. Now let me make one more definition. Let me define a parameter h bar squared k squared over 2 mkt. That's kinetic energy divided by kt. So that's some dimensionless number. I'll call that eta. And now I can do this change of variables. I have a k squared dk. And if you do this change of variables to eta, you'll see that k squared dk is a bunch of constants times eta to the 1/2 times d eta. Right, just a change of variables for the integration. So if I use that, then I can, instead of integrating over k, I can integrate over eta, and I'll get an integral that looks like this. So I have a whole bunch of constants out front, and then I have an integral of eta 1/2 d eta, that came from this change of variables, 1 plus e to the eta minus eta f on the bottom. Okay. So it looks simpler, okay, but it can't be done analytically. But people have given this thing a name or something close to it. So if I divide by 1 over the square root of pi, so that'll take this pi squared in the denominator and make it a... if I divide by... I took out a 1 over square root of pi, so I'll have a pi to the 3/2 over here. Then this is something that most of you have probably seen before. What is it? It's a Fermi-Dirac integral of order 1/2. So depending on what the power is that eta is raised to here, we'll get different factors in front, but all of the integrals will look the same. This particular one can't be done analytically. You know, people have published various approximations. You know, we have MATLAB scripts that will give it to you. You know, there are tables of them. Some powers you can do analytically. Some powers you can't. But in the end, then, all I need to do is to collect up all of these constants, and I'll call them the effective density estates. And I'll give this integral that I can't do a name. It's f to the 1/2 of a to f. It's the Fermi-Dirac integral of order 1/2. Okay. All right, so we've worked it out. We've done as much as we can do. If you tell me the location of the Fermi energy with respect to the bottom of the band, then I know A to F. Then I can go and find a MATLAB script that'll tell me what F to the 1/2 is. The effective density estates has the material parameters and temperature in it. And we've got the answer as much as we can give it. So now there's one thing. If we had done this for a non-degenerate semiconductor, a non-degenerate semiconductor would be one where the Fermi level is way below the conduction band, so A to F is very negative, large and negative. So if A to F is large and negative, we could have made that approximation right at the beginning in the Fermi function, and then we would have had an integral that we could have worked out. And then instead of getting a Fermi-Dirac integral here, we would have gotten an E to the A to F. we would have gotten an e to the ef minus ec. And that's the expression you get in 606 or 305 when you do a non-degenerate semiconductor. So this Fermi function becomes an exponential whenever you're non-degenerate. Actually, it turns out a Fermi-Dirac integral of any order becomes an exponential when you're non-degenerate, which is useful to remember. Okay. So if you look at this, actually what happens is that if you plot log of the Fermi function versus a to f, the exponential would just be a straight line and it would keep going. The Fermi function slopes off. So for a given location of the Fermi level, you'll have fewer carriers. You know, if my Fermi level is somewhere here, if I use Boltzmann statistics, I would have used an e to the a to f and multiplied the effective density of states times that value, and I would have gotten a number that's too big because the Fermi function is a little bit smaller. And it's because it's taking account, you know, when you do Boltzmann statistics, you're assuming that all states are empty, but when you do Fermi-Dirac, some of them fill up and you can't put any more electrons there. Yeah.
Where does like a e to f positive and negative or zero fit in that graph?
Yeah, it's a good question. So if I have a conduction band, you know, valence band, and I have a Fermi level somewhere, if a to f is zero, the Fermi level is right at the bottom of the conduction band. Now, I don't know, I just sketched this in here. You know, that's going to be somewhere here. When you go through in 606 or 305 and ask when can you use non-degenerate statistics, there are some arguments that you need to be, the Fermi level needs to be a few kT below the conduction band, which means A to F needs to be negative, some small number, negative 2, 3, 4, 5. You know, there's no sharp definition. When you're right at the conduction band edge, when A to F is zero, the Boltzmann approximation is in error a little bit. You know, sometimes you can go ahead and use it, you don't make too big of errors. But when A to F becomes positive and the Fermi level is above here, the errors just get increasingly big. Yeah. Okay, so there are a few things you should know. So this is something that you should spend a little bit of time on because it's worth doing. You know, we'll be working these out for other problems, and we will frequently get integrals that look like this, but there's a different power here. It's not one half. Okay. It's a different type of Fermi-Dirac integral. It's a Fermi-Dirac integral of order J. All right. J can be 0, 1, 2, 3 halves, minus 1. Okay. It depends on the problem. You get different ones. The factor out front, the 1 over square root of pi that we got for f to the 1 half, that'll be different depending on what j is. In general, it's 1 over the gamma function with an argument j plus 1. Right? And you might remember that this gamma function, when the argument is an integer, the gamma function is the factorial of n minus 1, 1 minus its argument. But the gamma function is defined when it's non-integer too. And gamma of 1 half is square root of pi. That's why we had the 1 over square root of pi in the f to the 1 half. And there's this relation that gamma of say, an integer, or gamma of an argument, like 1 half plus 1, is equal to the argument times gamma of p. So this is a recurrence relation that you can frequently use, like, what's gamma of 3 halves? I haven't told you. You could figure out what gamma of 3 halves is, because if p is 1 half plus 1, this is gamma of 3 halves that we're trying to figure out, then p was 1 half, it's gamma of 1 half. I know gamma of 1 half. So when you need to figure out the gamma function for other arguments, you can use that. You should try to remember that whenever you have a Fermi Dirac integral of any order, if you're non-degenerate, which means the Fermi function is way below the band, it becomes an exponential. Everything gets simple. And it is also useful to remember that if you differentiate one of these Fermi functions with respect to its argument, it just kicks it down one. So some problems we're going to have to differentiate. Say, if you differentiate a Fermi-Dirac integral of order 1/2, it becomes a Fermi-Dirac order integral of order minus 1/2. Okay. And my student, Rasong Kim, has put together a really good set of notes about Fermi-Dirac integrals. And you really should read them. If you read that, you'll probably know everything you'll need to know in your career for Fermi-Dirac integrals. There isn't a lot. You just need to know a little bit about how to use them and how they come about. You know, and then later on when you're reading a paper and somebody is talking about using the Sommerfeld expansion, you probably won't remember what the Sommerfeld expansion was, but you might remember, I remember reading about that somewhere, and then you can dig up the notes and see what it is. It's an approximation to a Fermi-Dirac integral. And one other thing you should have to be careful about, and this causes a lot of confusion. I get emails from people who think we have errors in our papers, and we frequently do, but not in this case. Right? You know, some people define Fermi-Dirac integrals without including these parameters out front. It's 1 over gamma function, right? If you do it this way, you don't have these nice relations like this. So people usually call the Fermi function that I've defined here, the Fermi-Dirac integral, they usually use a script F when they mean that. And this is a Roman F when they don't have those normalization factors. If you don't use the right one, then your answer will be off by square root of pi or something. Right. And people aren't always consistent. Sometimes they mean the script one, but they've used a Roman. So you just have to be careful and see what it is that they're doing. Okay, so you know, in the course, we will try frequently to use Boltzmann statistics, so we'll deal with exponentials because it's easier. Or we'll assume k equals 0, complete degeneracy, and then you can work things out analytically. But when you're analyzing data, unfortunately, you're very, very often in this regime where your Boltzmann statistics don't quite work, t equals 0, you know, you're at room temperature, and that's not necessarily a good approximation either. And then you just have to deal with Fermi-Dirac integrals. But I think if you go to this website, there's even a MATLAB script there that will compute them for you for any order. So, you know, it's no big deal when you have to do it. Okay. All right. One more thing. I'll go a little bit faster. All right, frequently we're working in energy space. So let's look at this. So we've talked about doing these sums in K space. And we know how to do them. We have a density of states in K space. We do the integral. I should integrate over a Brillouin zone. I have to be careful with this. All right, so we could do the integral like that. I had done it earlier instead of integrating explicitly over these angles. If I integrate over phi, I'll get a 2 pi. If I integrate over sine theta, I'll get a 2. And that'll give me about 4 pi k squared dk. I was just neglecting the angular dependence. Sometimes when we do sums, we'll try to do things like x-directed velocity, and we'll have to get the angular dependence in. But that can be done. So we've talked about how we do this in k space. Okay, but you could do it a little bit differently. We could take this integral that we started with before, and we could do a change of variable to energy space. So if I have parabolic bands, again, I need to assume a dispersion. I could solve for k squared in terms of energy. It's 2m over h bar squared e minus ec. So I could solve that for k, just take the square root, and then I could differentiate and I could solve it for dk. So I could solve for k squared dk and write it in terms of energy, right? I need to know the dispersion to do that, but I needed to know it anyway, right? So I could convert it to energy space, and now I'm just doing a change of variables from k space to energy space. And since I know the dispersion, I can do that. All right, it's going to work out the same. Okay, now I'm integrating from the bottom of the conduction band. I should integrate to the top, but I can usually let that go to infinity because the Fermi function will make it go to zero. And most of you are probably more familiar with finding electron densities by starting here, by integrating the Fermi function times the density of states over all the energy. Well, here we integrated over k space. We just did a change of variable to energy. So if you just collect up those constants, it looks like our density of states in energy space is proportional to the square root of energy. Okay. So you can do it either way. We could just start here if we knew the density of states and work out the integral. For many problems, it's going to be easier to work in k space. So you want to be able to do it either in k space or in energy space. Sometimes it gets a little, like if you want to know the total current directed in the x direction, it gets a little harder to do it in energy space, because where do you get the direction into this? All you have is the total energy. In k space, you've got directions, kx, ky, kz, so it's easier to do. Okay, so let's see what we're... Oh, the point we're going through here is you can just go through everything now and work this out and do a change of variables, define A to F exactly the way we did it before, define A to here as energy minus bottom of the conduction band over kT. That's just like h bar squared k squared over 2mkT before. And in the end, you know you have to get the same answer. And that's what we get. So we work it out in k space, or we work it out in energy space. In the end, you get the same answer. But you should be equally familiar with working it out in both. Okay, and then we'll just discuss one or two things and we're done. I'm going to spend a little more time talking about density of states in another lecture, but let's look at a very simple band here. You have energy versus k. So the nice thing about k space is that the states are just uniformly spaced. Everything is very simple. And they're spaced 2 pi over Lx. No problem. Each one of those states corresponds to some energy. It depends on the E of k relation. I've drawn a parabola here. So I could go through with each of those, and I could just map to its corresponding energy. Now you can see that the states are not uniformly distributed in energy. They're distributed however the dispersion forces them to be. Right? They're always distributed uniformly in k-space, but the shape of this E of k is going to distribute them differently in energy. Okay. So when I'm working in k-space, I'm asking how many states are there in this region dk. When I'm working in energy space, I'm asking how many states are there between E and E plus dE. And they're non-uniformly distributed, but I'm just mapping one to the other, or counting the same number. All right. So there's where frequently you need to use something more sophisticated than a parabolic band for your problem. The number of states always has to be the same, right? So this is d of e times little dE. This is the total number of states in this range of energy. That's the same number of states, n of k dk, in the corresponding range in k space. So if you work that all out, you've seen most of this before. Here's a density of states in 1D, 2D, 3D. I'm assuming that the energy is greater than the bottom of the conduction band because there are no states below the conduction band. Right. Look at the 2D. If you work out, you could work out this sum in 2D, and you could go through all the arguments that I did, and you could convince yourself that the 2D density of states is effective mass over pi h bar squared. Of course, that's only the 2D density of states when the band is parabolic, right? But that's probably something that you've seen before. What's this? GV. Yeah, so you always have to ask yourself, you know, in bulk silicon, you have 6 equivalent conduction bands, you know, so... you know, we've worked out one of these for near the bottom of one of these minima, but there are 5 others, you know. So you have to figure out how many degenerate valleys are there, equivalent valleys. each one of them, you know, is treated the same way, and then you just multiply by the number.
So it's kind of like those summations in front of the integrals that we had earlier?
Yeah, yeah. Instead of just summing over subbands in the bulk, we're like, or even in any case, we're summing over the number of independent valleys. Yeah. So like in graphene, some of you are working in graphene. There are, if you look at the Brouwer zone in graphene carefully, there are two equivalent valleys. So we compute the density states for one of them, we compute the carriers, and then we multiply by two. So you always, you have to know something about the EK and what the valley degeneracy is to do that. In 3D, it's usually not written this way. It's usually a little more complicated. When you do silicon, you know, you have ellipsoidal valleys. You have a different effective mass in the X, Y, and Z direction. Actually, two of them are the same. So in these six valleys, they're pointed in different directions. So M in the X direction is the longitudinal effective mass in some cases. It's a transverse effective mass in other cases. And then you have to add the contributions from all six of those. People frequently, so this is some combination of effective masses. And the valley degeneracy, everything is usually in silicon lumped together. And this GV parameter and all of those different effective masses are all put together. And this is called a density of states effective mass. Have you seen that? You've come across that? Do you do that in 606? Okay. Now, you know, physically, the way we think of an effective mass is it's the curvature of the band. Right, you have an EK, you compute the curvature, that's the effective mass. The density of states effective mass is really not, it's not a, you can't go to an EK and look at it and see what it is. It's some mathematics that is arranged so that your final result looks this simple. You collect everything up and you define something called a density of states effective mass so that you could put it into an equation that just has one simple spherical mass and get the right answer. That's what a density of states effective mass. And then there's conductivity effective mass. When you talk about current, there's frequently some different combinations of effective masses that come in when you sum over all of the different ellipsoids. Yeah, so I wanted to point out, I've been doing it for parabolic bands. You know, if you have a different dispersion, you'll get a different answer, right? And this is, you know, it's very, at this stage point, there's something you want everyone to understand very clearly. You know, when you have a graphene problem, do not write down, graphene is a two-dimensional sheet of carbon atoms. So you might think, I'm dealing with a two-dimensional density of states. I know the two-dimensional density of states. It's m over pi h bar squared. That's for parabolic bands, it is, yeah. You need a two-dimensional density of states, but you have a different dispersion. So you've got to figure out what is the proper two-dimensional density of states for that material. And it's quite different. In a parabolic band, it's independent of energy. It's constant. But in graphene, it goes linearly with energy. Just the fact that they have different EKs. No. And here, I probably shouldn't even do this. I'm showing if you really want to think about this result, like this result, if you really want to do that, you could just do a little bit of algebra on that, divide the top by v squared. Let's see. And then I will define, I'll say energy is m times vf squared. Boom, boom, boom. And then I've got m over pi h bar squared. M over pi h bar squared, boom. All right, then it looks like the result that you might have seen. Now, actually, that says E equals mc squared, mv squared. It even looks plausible because this dispersion looks like dispersion for photons, and E equals mc squared for them. But I hope that doesn't confuse the point that you derive this for a parabolic band where it's very clear the effective mass is the curvature at the bottom of the band. What you should do when you want the density of states for a different material is start with the EK and derive the density of states. Okay, now I'll point out there are lots of other sums that we could do. You know, we might be interested in things like electron density. You might be interested in things like what is the average kinetic energy per electron. So I would take the energy minus the bottom of the conduction band, that's the kinetic energy of that particular K state, multiply it by the probability that that state is occupied, and sum over all the states, and then just do the sum in order to normalize this thing, just do the sum over all of the states here. The result, this is something that you can do now. And if you do it in general, you'll get a Fermi-Dirac integral of some order, I don't recall what. If you do it in the non-degenerate limit, you'll find that the average energy is 3/2 kT, which is also, you know, useful to carry around. If you do it in 2D, it's 1 kT. If you do it in 1D, it's 1/2 kT. It's 1/2 kT for each degree of freedom. If you want to ask what's the average velocity, we would just weight the sum by the velocity. But there are just as many positive velocities as negative velocities in equilibrium, so the average would always go to zero. However, you could ask, what is the average velocity of the positive velocity half? Then you would just sum over kx is greater than zero. Don't sum over the negative kx's. So we weight the velocity times f, divide by the sum over f to normalize. This time you'll get a finite answer. And in the non-degenerate limit, you'll get the square root of 2 kt over pi m. And that we're going to see very frequently. And it's frequently called the thermal velocity. So again, you should be able to work all of these out. Actually, I'm going to skip this. I'll come back when we have a discussion, since we're running over time, and talk a little bit more about thermal velocity and make the point that when people say you use the thermal velocity in this problem, what you want to ask is, what thermal velocity do you mean? So there are different things that people mean by thermal velocity. So we'll talk about that later. So here's what I suggest you do. Be sure that you can work some of these out. I mean, otherwise you're going to be struggling with the math for the rest of the course and you won't be able to concentrate on the concepts. You could work out the ones that I have there on slide 25. You could also work them out for graphene and see what things change for different band structures. Okay, so we've run a little bit over. I'm still calibrating myself on how much time that we can do. As I said, we will be here on Friday. Okay. But unless I hear some really good objections to why we shouldn't do it, we will begin Monday in meeting in Armstrong 1109. Okay.